came to McLeod. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. And suddenly when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except for Jesus. Now, if you are unfamiliar with a liturgical church or a kind of a traditional way of having the gospel worked out in Sunday worship, what we have today is going to be a real treat. Today, the Feast of the Transfiguration. Now, it's a big word. It's not transformation, but it's kind of close. So I'm going to help you along with this. I'll say it, you say it. Transfiguration.
Transfiguration.
To be transfigured is to be transformed. That your figure, your body, the way that you look, suddenly, somehow, some way, is totally different. So with Jesus, in this transfiguration, not just any transfiguration, but the transfiguration, something happens to the way that he looks. And suddenly, he is glowing, and he is shining, and it is so bright, and it is so crazy, it is so indescribable and unbelievable that his closest friends, these three disciples who are up on the mountain watching him, they're all freaked out. They don't even have a good way to describe this. The best they could come up with was,
it was like he had bleached it, really, really bleaching.
And they can't come up with a way to describe just how amazing this particular moment was. How incredible, how different he looked. What this all meant, what was going on. And yet there on the mountaintop is Jesus. And suddenly, as though he were so bright, they can't even look right at him. And we remember this and set it aside as a particular thing, you know, as a remembrance, as a commemoration, as a day. I called it a feast because of what this moment means. What this moment means in the whole gospel story, you know, I didn't pick these readings. Because it's a traditional liturgical service, we use a lectionary, which means that, you know, something from the Old Testament, a psalm and a New Testament, and they picked this stuff hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And we just kind of rotate through a cycle. And so this Sunday, these are the readings that we're given. And we'll go all the way through the gospel story from, you know, the birth of Jesus at Christmas and waiting for him in Advent. And, you know, we'll go all the way around all year long and we'll start all over again next year. So this moment is set aside because it's important for the year. It's important for the gospel story. And it's important for us. Let me try to explain. It's important for the year because in the church year, where it's not just every day, but kind of the seasons sort of have a flow to them. That there are certain things that we can look forward to, certain things that we can appreciate, certain things that are opportunities that we can take a part of. So Easter, for instance, that's coming up, but it's not here yet. It's a real early Easter this year. Anybody know the dates? April 1st. April Fool's Day! Yeah. So, anyway, it's a real early Easter based off of, you know, that moving calendar. So, in a traditional liturgical church, you want to spend some time preparing for Easter. You don't get surprised, oh my gosh, there are eggs and bunnies! You know, you take the season of Lent with its 40 days and 40 nights, just like Jesus himself was in the wilderness for preparation for his public ministry. We take this time because we want to be more like him. We want to be ready for Easter, so maybe you do some extra things, or you don't do some normal things. Maybe you're going to read your Bible more. Maybe you are going to pray more. Maybe you are going to go offer service to somebody in need more. Or maybe you're going to give some things up. People give up chocolate or sweets or drink. So something that is not a bad thing, but they've said, for this brief period of time, I'm going to set that aside because I want to focus on the Lord. That at the end of it, I've spent that time and I've spent that focus getting closer to him, and I'm going to look a little bit more like him when I'm done. Well, I'm going to get to Easter, and I'm going to be ready to celebrate with the joy of the resurrection just a little deeper. I am going to think a little more like Jesus. I am going to act a little more like Jesus. My will, my insides, my heart, they're going to look just a little more like Jesus because of this time of preparation. Well, who likes to not eat delicious food? Who likes working a little harder? All of these things we kind of associate with being ready for Easter roulette. I mean, maybe you wouldn't necessarily sign yourself up for that. Maybe it's going to be kind of hard to change your schedule or to change your perspective. Maybe it's gonna feel like a drag at times. Oh, I love studying the Bible. I'm gonna study it twice as much as I do. And that works for like 3 days. And then on day four, you're like, I'm really kind of busy and I'm sort of tired and, you know, it'll be there when I come back. So, and you know, one day leads to the next, and suddenly, this discipline that you took on, it kind of, okay? You were given, Cub Scouts, parents, you were given a block of wood weeks ago. Obviously, you spent a little bit of time every day honing and shaping that Pinewood Derby car so that the day before Pinewood Derby, you would spend weeks and weeks crafting it just so, correct? Or were you up Friday night finishing? Okay, so best laid plans, and it can be like that. It can be hard. It can be frustrating. We have these great ideas. Oh, it's going to be so good, but then you get in the midst of it, and you just kind of... And you set it aside, and I'll pick it up later. Life is kind of like that, where you've got good plans, and you've got good intentions, you've got good desires of ways you want to be or things that you want to do, but hardships happen, and difficulties happen. If any among you are convinced that all the difficult things in life are now in your past, that's what I said to the Sunday school group, check your pulse, because you might be dead. Hardships are going to happen. Difficult times are still yet to come. Whatever you've done in the past, it might just come back around again, or it will be creatively new. Some brand new difficulty, some new sorrow, some new sadness, some new sickness. Hard times come, period, the end. As long as we're in this mortal life, it kind of does this. You know, if you're on the up and up and you're always on the mountaintop, then explain to me your secret. Because sometimes it's, everything's really great. And sometimes, I don't want to get out of bed. And so within those hard times that are coming, how do you push through, even if you know this hard time won't last, how do you keep on going? How do you have the wherewithal? How do you have the motivation to continue through the hard times and find those good times or those happy times that you're convinced will still come? You're working on a marriage. You're working on a skill, or you're making a plan. If you're anything like me, it starts off with a lot of enthusiasm. Yes, I'm going to totally do this. I'm going to rock those knots, and I'm going to get them all. Or, you know, you've got this event planned out and the camping trip, and it's going to be fabulous. We're going to go to that place that does human foosball. Everybody loves that one. But then there comes a point where the actual practical preparation starts to get on your nerves. It's not just fun anymore. It's not just this exciting possibility, but somebody has got to go do all the shopping. Somebody has actually got to remember if it goes right over left or left over right to make that not correct. Somebody has to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and to make sure this stuff comes about, and it starts getting frustrating. You start getting tired of it. You start getting annoyed with it. And I just wish it was red. All done. That enthusiasm that you started off with, it begins to wane. How do you push through? By and large, we push through hard times in life or the frustrations of scouting because we believe that even the hard times, A, they won't last, and B, something better will come through them. We learn the skills, we do the events, we put up with all of the camping and sleeping on the ground because we believe that it's going to lead somewhere better, somewhere blessed even. Something that will be worthwhile. And even the hard times of life, we push through because there is no single hard time that is the end. And we believe that there is something more. And so, the Feast of the Transfigurations offers to our year, to the gospel story and our life, the hope for what that more is. That rationale for continuing on. That motivation for when things are difficult or annoying or frustrating or we can't seem to put them together right. Within the gospel story, Jesus is there with his disciples. He is on top of the mountain, and suddenly there is Moses and there is Elijah. These guys have been gone for a long, long time. And also they're there with Jesus. He is being flanked then by the law and the prophets. Moses, who brings the Ten Commandments and the law. Elijah, who the Old Testament says is a mighty prophet. The mighty prophet of God who does all of these amazing and miraculous things. There are no people who are bigger, who are more important, or more significant to the Old Testament than Moses and Elijah. And there they are with Jesus, who says, I am the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. I'm not come to sweep you away. I've not come to say the Old Testament doesn't count. I am not here to say that there is no law and prophets. I am here to fulfill them for your sake. Jesus is there with the law and the prophets, and then suddenly he's dazzlingly bright and shining. Did you know that Peter and James and John were scouts? Did you know that? Did you catch that context clue from our reading? Because when they were overwhelmed by seeing Jesus and Moses and Elijah, and they didn't know what to do, and they didn't know how to describe it, what was the only thing they could come up with? Let's pitch a tent. That's a scouting joke, people. Come on. Jesus is there, flanked by the Old Testament, in flesh. And it's there fulfilled in him, the voice of God the Father, just like at his baptism. Just like when he was in the River Jordan, the dove of the Holy Spirit comes down. The voice of God the Father says, this is my beloved Son. Listen to him. And Moses and Elijah, they disappear, they're gone again, and it's just Jesus. For this fleeting glimpse, these guys have seen the glory of God. For this barest of moments, there on a mountaintop, with all of the Old Testament being fulfilled, with the voice of God the Father still thundering in their ears, they had a flash to see the glory of God. Just in the face of Jesus that shone so bright, they don't even know how to describe it right. So when I say that this is the fulfillment of the gospel, this is a part of the gospel story, and it's a part of our lives, well, in the gospel story, what's going to happen after this? They're going to go down off the mountain. And Jesus, as they say, is going to set his face towards Jerusalem. That means he's going to make up his mind to say, from here on out, I'm not just traveling from town to town preaching and teaching and healing. I am headed towards Jerusalem. What will be waiting for him in Jerusalem? A cross. Okay? So he has now made up his mind. It is time. It is time, and I am headed to suffering. I am headed to betrayal. I am even headed to death, because I do it out of love for your sake and for the sake of the world. That death won't be the end. That tomb which will be filled by his body will be empty, and he will be resurrected. But it happens after this. This is that last moment where he shares something with his disciples, and no matter what happens next, it's going to get ugly, guys. It's going to be bad. Some of you are going to, you're going to ignore me or betray me. Some of you are going to say, I never met the guy. When push comes to shove, I'm going to be by myself. And people are going to say terrible things. And people are going to do terrible things. You will watch me suffer and you will watch me die. But before any of that happens, when the going gets tough, when you feel like you're deep down in the valley, when it feels like it's nothing but darkness and suffering and sorrow, you remember this moment. You remember the glory of God. Those hard times are coming, but what's going to get you through? Oh, remember when we were on the mountaintop? Oh. Remember, it was like Moses and Elijah, and then all of a sudden, bam! It was the very glory of God. We we saw him. It's like seeing God face to face for just a second. That will be enough light to carry you through even the dark times that will still come. And that's the way in our life too. We make this a special time, the Feast of Transfiguration, because in your life those hard times will come. Those dark times will come. Those difficulties, they are bound to happen. What will be your motivation? What will be your strength? What will be your guiding light to get you through? Everybody needs a guiding light. If you do not believe me, go camping with the scouts, have to go to the bathroom at 2 o'clock in the morning, and be unsure which direction the bathroom is in. You need something to show the way. You need something to illuminate and to brighten that which you cannot see. You need something so that you don't trip and fall. And even if you do, you know that you can get up again because you know your ultimate destination. Christ, who is the light of the world, acts like that flashlight or that lantern deep and late at night. We can trust in him that our destination is secure. That in him, there is a light to enlighten any darkness, any trouble, any difficulty. It's like seeing God face to face when we look at him. And there is enough light, even for the dark times, that will still come. Well, I said it's important to our lives, and we will have hard times. Well, what is it about the face of Jesus that would be so bright for us? We want to say, you know, that's the sort of light I want in me. What does that mean, and what does it do? We have to go back one reading and see what Paul wrote to the Corinthians. We have to remember that when Paul writes to those Christians in Corinth, he is writing to a group of people initially where it's kind of a convergence of three major cultures. Okay, we have the Jewish Hebraic Hebrew culture. You know, a lot of the folks that Paul is writing to, they were Jews, and they have come to accept Christ as the Messiah. Paul himself, very, very faithful Jew, comes to believe in Christ. So he is writing with people who understand that and who connect with that. But what's going on in the larger world at this time? They are all a part of the Roman Empire. Rome has spread, you know, from sea to sea, and all of these places and all these people, they are actually under the authority and the empire of Rome. And this part of time and history is referred to as Hellenistic because of the culture of the ancient Greeks. You know, the guys who came up with different philosophies, who invented democracy, and all this kind of stuff, that this spread through this entire region, kind of unifying all these different tribes and different people with this new way of thinking. And so you've got these three cultures who are kind of converging all in this same place, and Paul is writing in a way that needs to speak to all three of them. So what does he say? For God who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the knowledge, to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. You have to hear those words carefully and thoughtfully. For what does the Hebrew value above all else? Light. Within the Old Testament, light and brightness not only illuminates you, but it's also typically tied to the manifestation of God himself. It's tied to the power of God. It's tied to the presence of God. In the beginning of Genesis, and there's nothing but darkness, how does God create? Let there be
light.
Isaiah writes, arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has dawned upon you. Light means God's glory. Light means God's presence. That's got to be the most important thing for a Jew, is to desire and to achieve the light of God. What about for the Roman? The Roman, different culture, different way of thinking. What was their number one achievement? What was the hope of this culture? What was the apex of what they were shooting for? It was glory. It was glory. Glory in our conquest. Glory in the building of the empire. Glory in our architecture. Glory in the way that we are unifying the world in this way of doing things in our laws and our systems. It is for the glory of Rome. It's the most important thing that we can come up with. It's what our hearts desire most. It's what we work for is glory. And what about the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, these philosophers who have influenced this entire area until we call that the Hellenistic world? These guys who came up with all of these thoughts, these guys who allowed their way of thinking to shape how they ordered life together, their ultimate achievement was knowledge. That's what you strove for. That's what you desired more than anything else. That's how you know when you've really made it, if you're an ancient Greek, is you have achieved knowledge. So hear it one more time. This is what Paul writes to the Corinthians. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts. The Hebrews want light. The Romans want glory. The Greeks want knowledge. He has made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory, displayed in the face of Christ. In the face of Jesus is the hope of every tribe, every language, every nation, every tongue, every culture, every society, every heart, every person. There is light, there is glory, there is knowledge, there is what each of us hope for and desire to achieve. And what is it? It could be anything. It could be anything. I want a good life for my kids. I want to feel important. I want to earn enough money to have a comfortable living. I want to be able to pass along a legacy. I want to feel powerful. I want to not feel lonely. I want to feel understood and connected to people. I want hope. And regardless of who you are, what you are, where you are, when you are, that burning desire, that apex of achievement, whatever it is that you feel built for and that you desire to possess and achieve amongst anything else, it is found in the face of Jesus. I want to be a good scout. I want to earn my merit badge. I want to make it to crossover. I want to make it to Eagle. I want high adventures. I want to be the sort of person when I grow up who is different because of scouting than I would have been otherwise. That's how we make it through the hard times and the difficult times. We have seen the glory of God in the face of Jesus, and what we hope for most is found in Him. Whatever it is. Hard times and difficulties come. The frustration, the sadness, the sickness, the hurt, they all continue to come no matter what. But when we look in the face of Jesus, when we see His light, it shines so bright we can't even describe it. What we hope for most, what we desire is best. It's all found right there, and it's enough. It's enough for the hard times. It's enough for the difficulty. It is greater than any darkness, and we can follow His light, we can look in His face, and we can see the way safely home. It is said that scouting, as designed by Lord Baden-Powell, was intended to be practical Christianity, a concrete way to work out your faith, to invest in younger generations so they might grow, not just in the full stature of mature adulthood, but into the full stature of Christ. And so what we do in these programs, it has a point, it has a purpose, and it has an end. And it's not just Eagle. And it's not just high adventure. And it's not just a merit badge or a belt loop. It's not just an achievement. It's not even the hope that these skills and these experiences and these relationships will do something within them and build them into better adults, better men, better women, people we can count on and trust, people that we can emulate, people that we want to be around. But the hope, as it was founded, is this is practical Christianity, and the end result is the glory of God. That light that shines so bright in the face of Jesus, that answers every hope. And it answers every heart. And Christ, the great scout, we can follow him and we can trust that his way is sure and it is true and it is safe and it is good. So whatever happens next, whatever happens later today, tomorrow, or next year, remember that you have seen the face of Christ. Remember that you have beheld the glory of God. Remember that the light that shines from him is greater than any darkness, and every hope is found in him, because he can and will be the path and be our guide to lead us all safely home.